Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast reviewing the clinic didactics for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Program. I'm Madhani Mohanachandran, and today I am so excited to be welcoming one of my co-faculty members, Erica Cunningham.
Hello.
And today we are going to be going over one of the didactics that Erica has edited, and credit also to Dr. Song and the authors of the Yale Didactic series that is focusing on hematuria. And so today we are going to focus on generating a differential diagnosis for blood in the urine, defining microhematuria and interpreting the results of urine dipstick testing, using the patient's history and clinical context to identify potential causes of hematuria, and using the American Urology Association guidelines to identify risk factors for urinary tract malignancy and determine an appropriate diagnostic strategy. And just as a reminder to everybody, as we do every episode, while we are going to be discussing cases, they are all theoretical. There is no PHI of any Virginia Mason patients that is being shared in this episode. All right, Dr. Cunningham, would you like to give us some evidence updates? It looks like the AUA actually very recently updated their guidelines. And so for those who are a little short on time, any major takeaways you want us to come away with?
I highly recommend bookmarking the AUA algorithm that's in the didactic and also in the guidelines. Even just doing a Google search for the 2025 AUA algorithm is going to really streamline your decision making around this. So the big key takeaways from the evidence updates is that we don't need to do extensive testing on the patients that have low or negligible risk for microhematuria, and we're going to go into how to classify patients of that in the didactic. And then for patients that have had a negative workup, so these are patients that had a higher risk and then underwent cystoscopy and imaging, the follow-up studies is really sort of based on shared decision-making and patients' risk factors. So for a lot of patients that have had a negative workup, we don't actually need to keep following it up on it. And the goal of this change is to reduce unnecessary testing that could harm low-risk patients, but also ensure that we're appropriately testing higher-risk patients. So I'm excited about this, but it also means that I have to think a bit more in my clinic. But the algorithm is really, really helpful and quite clear.
Yeah, this is a major change, I feel like, to most of our practices, where there was a very clear requirement that if there's blood in the urine, you're going to follow this pathway of doing imaging, sending them to radiology for cystoscopy. And now we're going to have patients where we thankfully don't need to be putting them through a lot of that stress, especially if they've got to go to another clinic for urology. Cystoscopies can be very scary for some of our patients, just the mental concept of. So that's actually really nice that we're not being overly invasive with patients when it's unnecessary. And then also saddling them with the costs of all these referrals and such.
Or the thought of a cystoscopy, which nobody's excited about.
And of course, we always want to highlight healthcare equity and healthcare disparities. So basically areas where we can work on in this particular topic to improve the disparities that we know exist in caring for our patients. What have you found when you were looking into this?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to first highlight the high-risk populations for this. These are older adults, men, smokers, people with exposures to carcinogens, such as aromatic amines, hydrocarbons. But when looking into the data around disparities, there is a big gap in gender. Women are a lot less likely than men to receive full evaluation, even if they are in the high-risk category. I think that might be in part due to people not really following guidelines and not recognizing the risk that's in women. Black patients receive fewer comprehensive evaluations in white patients, and then underinsured and publicly insured patients, people on Medicaid, tend to have lower evaluation than those that have private insurance.
And I think one of the really great things that this particular set of disparities really highlights is that it's not just, you know, some of the systemic issues that are contributing to the disparities. It's actually the fact that we have clear guidelines on how we should be taking care of our patients, and, you know, whether we are rushed for time, whether we're not fully up to date on the updated guidelines, for any of those reasons, that it's when we are not fully adhering to the guidelines, that's how we are adding to these further delays in diagnoses. And so it really does behoove us to try to stay as up to date as possible. And you, of course, you know, directed us to that very lovely algorithm. So it's not just us, you know, trying to scroll through paragraphs and paragraphs of recommendations. it is very nicely put together in a very clear picture to walk you through. And hopefully that will save people time to be able to appropriately manage these cases. All right.
Absolutely.
So let's go ahead. I'm going to challenge you with a case that was put together, provided by the Yale Reader, put together by Mary White, that was then updated by you. And so we are going to be talking about Mr. M. He is a 75-year-old man. He comes in for an annual visit. He feels well. He has no concerns to report. He has a history of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, benign prostate hypertrophy, and stage 2 chronic kidney disease. His medications include apixaban, lisinopril, hydrochlorothiazide, atorvastatin, and tamsulosin. On his yearly labs prior to your appointment, you notice that his kidney function has worsened to CKD stage 3B. So you obtain a urinalysis in clinic to start to investigate the cause of his worsening kidney disease. He's found to have a positive blood result on his urinalysis. This is then reflexed by the lab to microscopic urinalysis, and he is found to have 7 red blood cells per high power field, with no protein cast dysmorphic red blood cells or other findings. So first off, as we start, how would you actually classify this urinalysis result?
So microhematuria is defined as equal to or greater than 3 RBCs per high power view on the microscopy. So that's looking under the microscope, not on the dipstick. And so this is a positive result for hematuria, but I just want to highlight that it's super important to confirm a positive dipstick with a microscopic analysis. There are a lot of false positives. These can come from things that people eat in vegetables, bacterial peroxidases, semen, hemoglobin, myoglobin. And if you catch myoglobin on the dipstick, you might think about rhabdomyolysis. One of my most proudest moments of residency was catching a case of rhabdo based on a urinalysis.
Very so nice.
It was a proud moment for me. Now, if patients have dysmorphic RBCs or casts, that needs to be evaluated first by the nephrologist for glomerular disease before doing a urologic workup. If it's absent and they are intact RBCs, do a urologic evaluation.
Okay, so it sounds like this patient has microscopic hematuria, at least on this particular urine sample. Do you need to repeat the urinalysis to confirm microhematuria?
Nope. According to the AUA 2025 guidelines, a single positive UA warrants an evaluation based on the patient's risk stratification. And this is because intermittent microhematuria can still indicate malignancy. So if we are repeating it to confirm, we could be falsely reassured by a negative result.
Okay, that makes sense. So then in that case, got the test, should patients be routinely screened for microhematuria?
No. And this is because there's generally a low cancer yield in evaluating random UAs. So the U.S. Preventative Task Force, ACP, AUA, all recommend against asymptomatic screening for all patients. Now, there is a little bit of controversy in the guidelines for working up for Lynch syndrome and some of those other very high-risk patients, but that's a bit beyond the scope of this, and I tend to defer to the specialists in those cases. But even in those situations, the AUA and ACP still recommend against routine screening.
Okay, that's good to know, especially when you have patients coming in asking, should they be screened? So this is something that I think will be really helpful for us to be able to share the guidelines and the data for that. So this patient's atrial fibrillation, they're on anticoagulation. Does that change evaluation at all?
It does not. These patients still need to be evaluated based on their stratification. Patients with anticoagulation have similar cancer risks as those that are not on it.
All right, so let's move on to the next part of the case. So Mr. M does have worsening CKD, but since there were no dysmorphic RBCs, protein, or casts in his urine, you're now less concerned for glomerular cause of his microhematuria and concerned for urinary tract etiology of his microhematuria and want to investigate further. So what information do you want to obtain from the patient?
So this is a situation where we do want to rule out benign transient causes. So if somebody has had a recent fall or injury, if they have had recent urinary instrumentation like a catheterization or cystoscopy, if they, although it doesn't apply to him, but if they're menstruating or have had recent sexual activity, this is a situation where we actually would repeat the UA just because these are transient causes that could lead to false positive. So in the absence of that, the other things that we would want to know about, are they having symptoms that would make us think about different causes of hematuria? So if they have flank or groin pain, nausea, vomiting, we'd be thinking about nephrolithiasis or potentially a kidney infection. If they're having dysuria, frequency, nocturia, urgency, we'd think about a UTI. However, if somebody has persistent microhematuria after a UTI, we actually need to work that up. So that should go resolve after treating for a UTI. Then we also want to think about local structural and or atrophic conditions. BPH may cause hematuria via prostatic vessels. These are still patients that, even if we're suspecting their hematuria is due to this, we still need to evaluate them if they meet the risk stratification for evaluation, but that could be playing a role. And then vaginal atrophy and prolapse can lead to possible mucosa trauma. So although this is not something I've been doing in my practice, if patients have this, it may be useful to catheterize them to get a specimen to distinguish the source. We also want to identify malignancy risk factors. That would be any prior gross hematuria, which carries a much higher risk of cancer, any history of urothelial carcinoma, greater than 30 pack year history puts people in a high risk category. Chemotherapy, especially cyclophosphamide, can increase the risk of bladder cancer, pelvic radiation, a history of congenital urinary tract abnormalities, occupational exposures, and the big ones here include benzene, aromatic amines that are found in dyes, textiles, Agent Orange. So we'd be thinking about that as this patient is a veteran from the Vietnam War. Other high-risk things include chronic indwelling irritants such as catheters, bladder stones, schistosomiasis.
Thank you.
I struggle with words.
No worries.
I also didn't like learning about that in medical school. So gross. Anyways, as a tangent. So, and then, of course, family history of hereditary syndromes such as Lynch syndrome, certain supplements that contain
aristolochic acid.
This is something I have not thought about before. And then arsenic exposure. That's something you might think about in contaminated well water.
All right. And I think it's really nice kind of seeing that definitely you can have benign causes of the hematuria, but if you don't have a great explanation that you can blame it entirely on the benign cause, we really do need to be following up on it, as well as all of the risk factors for potential cancer. So getting back to our case, Mr. M tells you that he is asymptomatic, he is actively smoking cigarettes and has a 50-pack year history. He has no personal history of chemotherapy or radiation, no family history cancer that he knows of. He is a Vietnam War veteran and worked as a mailman for his entire career. He only takes the medications that his doctor prescribes for him and is unaware of any other exposures. So how do you risk stratify patients? And based on their risk group and using the 2025 AUA guidelines, what are the evaluations that's recommended for our three risk groups?
For low or negligible risk patients, to meet criteria for this, you have to meet all of the criteria that are in this group. These are women less than 60, men less than 40 years old. These are patients that have never smoked or smoked less than 10 pack years. They have small amounts of RBCs per high power views. Those would be 3 to 10 on a single UA. And they don't have any urothelial cancer risk factors. So for these patients, the recommended evaluation is to repeat the UA in 6 months. And then if the hematuria persists, then we talk to the patient about how they would like to be evaluated. Some of these patients may wish to just continue to monitor. Other ones, they may want to go ahead and get the cystoscopy and imaging, which for a low-risk patient would be, if they choose that, would be a ultrasound. Now, if they develop symptoms of gross hematuria, if there's a significant increase in the amount of blood in the urine, or they have new symptoms, we really have to reclassify them as intermediate or high risk depending on what their symptoms are and their findings. And it would not be appropriate to just keep monitoring those patients with UAs. We'd need to work them up more. The next level of risk is intermediate risk. And these are patients that meet one or more of the following criteria. So these are women that are greater than 60 or men that are 40 to 59. These are people that have smoked 20 to 30 pack years. These are patients that have 11 to 25 RBCs per high power view on in single UA. And these are patients that have one or more urothelial risk factor, or they might have been a lower risk patient with a persistently elevated RBC count on their UA. And the recommendation for this is a cystoscopy and a renal ultrasound. And this is because these are still patients that have a fairly low incidence of cancer, and a renal ultrasound is plenty sensitive enough for evaluating for cancers. So it avoids some of the radiation and exposure that a CT scan would entail. High-risk patients are those that meet one or more of the following. These are men over age of 60 or 60 and older. These are people that have smoked greater than 30 pack years. These are people that have greater than 25 RBCs per high-powered view. Anybody with a history of gross hematuria, and people that have any high-risk features that we just discussed and that I just mentioned, and a urothelial risk factor of greater than one. And for these, this is where we would get the cystoscopy and the CT urogram. And this provides the highest sensitivity for finding upper tract malignancies that might slightly be missed by the ultrasound. Some general diagnostic principles. A cystoscopy is really essential. It has a high sensitivity for bladder cancer of 98%, and this is something that is often not seen on a CT scan or ultrasound, especially for those in situ cancers. A kidney ultrasound is really good for finding or kidney cortical tumors, but it's a little bit less sensitive for urothelial cancers. And then the CT urogram, that's better at detecting the urothelial cancers, and we use this mainly for high-risk patients due to the cost radiation that is just not necessary for a lower-risk patient to be exposed to. So this patient is high-risk due to their age, gender, smoking history, exposure to Agent Orange.
All right, so you are planning to do, it sounds like, a cystoscopy and a CT urogram for this mm-hmm. patient with their high risk. What would you do if his workup was negative?
Yeah, so this is what's seen in about 50% of patients, and probably more in people that have negligible risk. But for this patient, we would consider repeating the UA in 12 months to evaluate for hematuria. And then certainly if they develop any new symptoms, or if they develop more risk factors. This is often a situation where I will rely a bit on the urologist to help guide the follow-up on a negative workup. Now, if this patient was intermediate risk or low risk, but we decided to do workup on them based on patient preferences, we may not need to do any further follow-up.
Okay. So how does the risk stratification apply for patients who are women? You brought up women and different age ranges for them and mostly kept it to the low and the intermediate risk ranges. So how does this generally apply to them?
So you mentioned that because women have a lower incidence, age alone does not make them go into the high-risk category, unlike for men. But a woman that's over 60 does put her in the intermediate risk, and we would need to do an evaluation. Certainly any woman that has a smoking history, gross hematuria, or additional risk factors does need to also be evaluated. And anybody with gross hematuria, high smoking history, is in the high risk and needs to be evaluated like a high-risk person.
All right, so essentially continue to risk stratify them. That way we don't have to worry about necessarily delaying diagnoses, worse outcomes, especially since I think a lot of times when we see blood in the urine for women, we sometimes get it mixed up with, okay, are you postmenopausal bleeding or attributing it to other sources of blood loss, and then potentially you're missing the bladder as a source.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to continue our case. Mr. M falls in the high-risk category as we discussed. You discussed with him the recommended approach for screening. He's concerned about the risk of radiation from CT scans as he already gets them for his lung cancer screening. He is also nervous about getting an invasive procedure with the cystoscopy. So he is wondering, could he do something like urine cytology? So how would you respond to his concerns?
Urine cytology is not indicated for routine initial work of microhematuria. It misses many urothelial cancers, and it has a false positive rate that's fairly high as well. So it's really of limited diagnostic utility as a screening tool. There are some select cases where a urologist might order it, such as if a patient has persistent hematuria after a negative cystoscopy and imaging, but they have some risk factors that they're worried about. And potentially it has a role in detecting carcinoma in situ that could be missed on a cystoscopy. But again, a cystoscopy has a sensitivity of 98%. I would not order this myself. I would only defer to urologists because I wouldn't know how to interpret the results of it.
I think that's very appropriate. So if Mr. M instead presented with an episode of gross hematuria, how would this affect your level of concern and evaluation?
Gross hematuria carries a 10 to 25 risk of genital urinary malignancy. That's a very high risk. And so these are absolutely patients that we would need to evaluate with cystoscopy and CT urogram. Now, we would need to rule out potential non-malignant causes like recent trauma or renal infarction or nephrolithiasis, because obviously those would be managed a bit differently. But if somebody is asymptomatic, aside from their gross hematuria, we absolutely need to evaluate that, or symptomatic of other things like cancer.
All right. Well, nicely handled with that case. Let's go ahead. We'll do a few quick cases and questions just to help everybody solidify their knowledge of how we manage hematuria. So your first case is a 55-year-old man with a 10-pack year smoking history who has a urine dipstick done at a health fair that was positive for blood. He is asymptomatic at this time. He presents to you asking if he should be concerned about this. What should be your next steps? A, refer to urology to have a cystoscopy and a CT urogram. B, reassure his concerns and do nothing. C, send a urinalysis to evaluate further. Or D, send a urine cytology.
Well, I would tell him not to get that screening. I'm joking. I can't. Now that we have the result, though, we need to actually send that for get another urinalysis for microscopy. And this is because very often they do have a positive urine dipstick and that are falsely positive.
All right, so next case. 30-year-old man, no past medical history, no concerning family history. Comes into the clinic after he notes gross blood in his urine. He reports that he had just completed a strenuous gym workout this morning. He is concerned and wants to know further steps for workup. So what do we tell him? A, go to urology. You need to have a cystoscopy and a CT urogram. B, repeat the UA after this episode resolves. C, reassure his concerns, do nothing. D, refer to urology to have a cystoscopy and a renal ultrasound.
So the answer for this is to repeat the urinalysis after the episode resolves. Even though gross hematuria is always concerning and it needs to be explored further, after a workout, it's frequently exercise-induced and transient that does not require further evaluation if the urinalysis comes back negative. But the timing after the workout is critical to this. If it was a few days after, then we would absolutely need to work it up like we would isolated gross hematuria.
Okay. Final case, 60-year-old woman presenting to clinic. She has a new diagnosis of CKD, and the UA reveals 5 RBCs per high-power field with no protein. And on urine sediment, she has dysmorphic red cells. She has a history of tobacco use. How would you proceed with her workup? A, evaluate her for glomerular causes of hematuria. B, refer to urology for cystoscopy and CT urogram. C, refer to urology for cystoscopy and renal ultrasound, or D, confirm the presence of blood on dipstick?
The answer is A, and the key here is the dysmorphic RBCs. This is concerning for glomerular disease, and we need to evaluate her for chronic kidney disease.
All right. Well, thank you for walking us through the whole updated AUA guidelines and algorithm on evaluating microscopic hematuria, reviewing a little bit about gross hematuria and that workup and the degree of risk, and going through our cases to help us identify what is low, intermediate, and high risk patients and how do we proceed with evaluation, and then also what to do after we do the evaluation, especially if it's a negative workup.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we will see everybody again next week for the next episode. Have a good day.